An historic trial is underway in the United States to help restore vision to blind patients by editing their DNA while it is in their bodies. CRISPR gene editing technology, I hope I've said that right, has been revolutionising scientific research by allowing doctors to rewrite genetic code to try and help people with conditions such as sickle cell anemia, and certain types of cancer. But this is the first time the technology has been used directly inside a patient, and there has already been success in people with inherited retinal diseases. Joining us now is Dr. Rachel Huckfeld, an associate surgeon and the director of the Inherited Retinal Degenerations Fellowship. Rachel, welcome to the program.
Hello, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being available. What is CRISPR? I hope I said that right. What is CRISPR?
Well, you said it perfectly, and it's an acronym for a very long name of clustered, regularly interspersed short palindromic repeats. And really what those are sequences of DNA that were first identified in bacteria. And in bacteria, we later learned, they serve as kind of a defense system or immune system for bacteria. So when a bacteria is introduced to a virus or is infected by a virus, it takes little snippets of that virus's DNA as a memory and sort of a warning system to help it respond to the virus the next time it's infected. And although those sequences had been identified maybe 20, 30 years ago, about 10 years ago, scientists realized what they could also be used for. They could be used to identify a target stretch of DNA of interest and use those sequences, those CRISPR sequences, to bring in molecular scissors, so to speak, an enzyme called Cas9, to snip the DNA but thereby have access to make modifications to it.
Molecular scissors. Wow, it sounds very science fiction-esque. Is it literally those kind of old visions people have of science fiction coming to life?
Oh, it certainly is. And we have colleagues who refer to it as genome surgery, which is such a nice description. The implications of the CRISPR-Cas system were only recognized 9-10 years ago. And here we are putting it into people's bodies and trying to cure these blinding diseases that have had no treatment and only distant hopes of treatment. So it's really quite revolutionary to be doing this here today.
Tell me the process of how, if this works, the body spurs itself to reproduce properly functioning genes.
Sure. So let's start by talking about how do we get this system into the body? And that's a little bit more science fiction. At least for the purposes of the retina, we use a virus that's been modified so that it's not disease-causing as a delivery truck. So you can pack the CRISPR-Cas system into this virus. And viruses' jobs is to infect cells. So here we're using it to infect the cells in the retina. So our retinal surgeons do a surgery that allows them to bring a very, very fine cannula or needle right down to the surface of the retina and then inject literally just droplets of fluid containing this virus, containing the CRISPR system. And then that virus infects the retinal cells. The retinal cells take up this DNA and they make the Cas9 enzyme. They have the CRISPR sequences, and those CRISPR sequences find those very precise DNA sequences that you want to modify in a person's genome. The Cas9 scissors come to work, and hopefully you correct the misspelling in the person's DNA, and with that correctly spelled DNA, you make functional protein. And in the case of the retinal conditions that I take care of, hopefully that functional protein will make rods and cones able to see light again.
And that's the way in which the body, quote unquote, corrects itself, right?
Yes. The genome editing is to correct the genetic misspelling that somebody was born with and restore function to these cells that are unable to operate correctly.
And it doesn't matter if someone was born with retinal issues or indeed they develop retinal issues over time, it still applies in the same way and potentially gets the same results.
That's a good distinction to make. So when we think about CRISPR-Cas right now, whether we're talking about the retina or diseases like sickle cell anemia, hereditary diseases, we're thinking about diseases where people were born with a misspelling in a gene, and that misspelling in the gene is sufficient to cause a disease, whether it's a hereditary kind of blindness or something like sickle cell disease or hemophilia. There are certainly acquired retinal conditions, common conditions like age-related macular degeneration, where genetic interventions like CRISPR-Cas may be useful in the future. Similarly, cancer is not a purely genetic condition most of the time, and there's going to be good utility for CRISPR-Cas there as well. But for the purposes of the retina, right now we're really thinking about diseases that people are born with.
Is it working? Have you found in the tests you've done so far that you're getting the results, Rachel?
That is a question we would all love to have answers to. And so this trial that is ongoing, which has a wonderful name of Brilliance, it is a phase 1/2 trial. So our primary goal is to just establish safety with efficacy as a second goal. And along those lines, there are two patients that have been treated and have shared some of their experiences just being in a trial with the public. But as for results, I think we're all going to have to sit and wait patiently for those a little bit longer.
How long do you think it will take to find out the results?
Thinking about all the molecular things that have to happen when this virus is delivered and the CRISPR system goes to work, I think it would be reasonable that someone might start noticing a difference within several months after treatment. But this is, the first time this has been done in people, so I can have, whatever expectations I want, but it's ultimately the very brave and courageous patients who enter these first-in-human trials who will be telling us when anything happens.
And how many people are you trialing the system with?
The trial was designed to have 18 patients, primarily adults, but if safety is adequately demonstrated in the adults, then children ages 3 to 17 may be eligible as well.
What are the risks, Rachel? Because it sounds, as you say, it's groundbreaking. And many people have said as well the pioneering nature of this test, and there will be risks. What are they?
So I think the first set of risks I think about is just the risk of a surgery and this viral vector we use. And we're gaining experience with that in ophthalmology for other retinal conditions using other genetic therapies. So we have a good handle on what to expect and how to handle that. CRISPR itself, though, it has its own set of risks. We are going in and using these molecular scissors to snip and modify someone's genome. We don't want to get the wrong part of their genome and manipulate or edit or change a gene that is functional in some way. That's a pretty you don't want to get that wrong, right? And so that's something that any trial using this has to really be certain of as they design their CRISPR system and as they do their initial preclinical work, not in people. I think in cells that divide, so not cells in the retina where cells you're born with the cells you'll die with, and cells in the body that divide frequently, you also might want to worry about or at least be sensitive to any chance of malignancy or other damage caused by the CRISPR-Cas system. Again, that's not a concern in the retina. And I think what makes the retina so different from some of the ex vivo ways that the system has been used so far in people, ex vivo meaning somebody's cells are taken out of their body, treated, and put back in their body, is we don't get a chance for quality control in the retina. If you are treating cancer or sickle cell and you take somebody's cells out of their body and do the treatment, you can check all these things and verify all these things and be satisfied before you put the cells back in the body. We don't have that backup step when we do this in the retina. And so it's a big deal to do this in people, and we're so excited to be a part of it.
What was the response of the patients when you first presented this to them and said that they would be a part of this clinical test, this trial process? How did they respond? What was their words to you?
These are patients who have often been told for decades that there's no treatment for their condition and don't have high expectations that there will be a treatment. So I think there is excitement, there is relief, just to have the possibility of a choice and the possibility of being in a trial. And then I think there's a moment of weight, right? The opportunity to be in this kind of trial, it takes a lot of deliberation for some patients. And so you can see it sometimes a deep breath and a, oh, the wheels start turning. But just on the whole, a lot of excitement that to have this opportunity.
What were their responses after the trial period when they had the treatments? What did they say to you?
So the patient that was treated at my hospital, Mass Eye and Ear, has just, I think, had gratitude the whole way to get to be in the trial, to have come through the initial stages and done well as far as safety goes. And this is an altruistic bunch of people. They are happy to have this opportunity for themselves, but when you hear them speak, they are happy to have this opportunity on the behalf of all the other people out there who might benefit from these treatments.
What would the options be for these people if this wasn't available, if this trial wasn't being undertaken? What are the other options they have for them?
Well, until about 3 or 4 years ago, there were no other options. The particular form of blindness that this trial is targeting is interesting because it's a common mutation. It's a common mutation in a rare gene. But there is another kind of gene-specific therapy being targeted to this exact same population of people. It's one where instead of modifying the DNA that someone's born with, you modify a downstream step in that process. You modify how the DNA is turned into a protein. And so it's a pretty tremendous moment in biomedical science where we have two possible strategies for this disease, and hopefully we'll see good outcomes from both ways of trying to treat this disease and hopefully have some good options for patients down the road.
Do you think, have you had to deal with any ethical issues that have arisen before the trial was commenced? And if so, what were those ethical issues that you had to deal with? Because as you say, I like the way you rephrased it. You said correcting misspelling. But it is obviously dealing with DNA. So what are the ethical issues that you have to deal with, and how do you deal with those?
I think in the realm of retinal diseases and probably a lot of the genetic disorders that are being targeted for CRISPR genome editing, some of the big ethical issues we don't have to deal with. We're not editing the germ cells or the sperm and egg cells that would be passed on to future generations. So we don't have to worry about designer babies or some of those very sticky things that our whole community should be thinking about scientifically and ethically and societally. So we get to just focus on one organ and one body system. I think the ethical issues are the same as with any first-in-human clinical trial and first-in-human treatment. The burden is on us as physicians and scientists to make sure that we have done our best to think about and assess and mitigate and prevent any kind of risk that these patients could experience.
It's been said that the eye is an ideal organ for testing new approaches like CRISPR. Why is that the case, Rachel?
There are several reasons. One is that the eye is relatively walled off from the rest of the body as far as the immune system goes. And so, whereas our colleagues in other fields have to worry a little bit more about immune responses, particularly to the viral vectors we use to deliver these agents, that's less of an issue in the retina. We also have the opportunity to see pretty directly what we do. If you come into a retina doctor's office, we take pictures every which way, and it really gives us an ability to, at a very fine level, monitor people's response, monitor their progress. And because the eye is walled off, it does, I think it helps with some of the safety in some regards of these first-in-human therapies.
You mentioned earlier that there that it also has been tested, I think this is what you said earlier, tested with patients with cancer as well. How does that work? Is it the same process but applied differently?
Yeah, so there's, I think, a few ways that it's been used. One is there's a newer form of cancer therapy called CAR T therapy, where someone's bone marrow sample is taken or blood sample is taken, and a particular kind of immune fighting cell, the T cell, is isolated. And that T cell is modified in such a way that it will be able to fight off cancer. So now scientists can do that CAR T process, but add some CRISPR-Cas genome editing on top of it to try to enhance the therapeutic ability even more. Again, that's an approach where you're taking cells out of a body and you have the ability to really know what you're putting back in when you give them back to the patient. The other way that this is being used in cancer is, I think, being developed to just as a system to fight cancers more generally. So to exploit some of the genetic signatures of particular cancers so that you have a way to, like with chemotherapy, you have a way to target the cancer cells and leave the other ones alone. So I think throughout medicine, a lot of powerful possibility here.
If the trial is successful, how accessible do you think this will be for people? And I'm thinking particularly around things like cost when I talk about access. There could be a concern that the cost to be able to get this kind of treatment could be exorbitant. How accessible will this be?
Yeah, that is a very real issue. So if this phase 1-2 trial is successful, then it will go into a phase 3 trial. And if that is successful, then hopefully we'll have eventually an FDA-approved drug that we can give to our patients. But whether they can get that drug, is the issue you raise. And we have a few points of comparison here. In 2017, the FDA approved a gene replacement therapy for a type of genetic blindness called Luxturna. And its price tag as a one-time treatment for each eye is close to $1 million. There's another genetic drug for a neurologic condition where the price tag for a one-time treatment is $2 million. So these are big costs. They're big costs for a health system. They're costs that a patient, can't afford out of pocket. So how do we as a society, support these drugs, but make sure the people who need them have access? I don't have a ready answer to that, but it's a real issue. And I think something that we will come up with solutions for. Otherwise, otherwise the medicines aren't getting to the people who need them.
Rachel, how many people are working on CRISPR technology right now?
That's a good question. I think if you go to any academic lab or any biotech company, you're going to find people working on it. I remember being a postdoctoral fellow in like 2015 and hearing about it being used for genome editing for the first time. And I was probably a little bit late to the table in 2015. And now it's ubiquitous. It's everywhere. It's hard to overstate the impact it's having.
And it's global too, right? There are lots of people working in this field throughout the world.
Yes. Yep, for sure.
Rachel, thank you so much for being available to us this morning. This blows my mind, literally. And unfortunately, I'm not much of a scientist, but you presented and answered these questions in a way that has made it understandable. So I really appreciate, certainly from someone with my lack of experience and expertise and knowledge, I've certainly appreciated the way in which you've answered the questions. When do you think you'll be able to get to phase 3 as a final question?
I hope that within a year or so, we have a better sense of not just safety, but efficacy. And we can use that data about efficacy to intelligently move forward to a phase 3 trial. So I hope we have more exciting things to talk about in the year ahead.
We look forward to speaking with you then. Thank you so much for being a part of the program and for speaking to us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Dr. Rachel Huckfeld there speaking to us on this amazing technology that is being undertaken